And in the same way, the epithet Vajra came to be attached to various other things as well. Enlightenment itself, Bodhi, came to be spoken of as Vajra Bodhi. Not just Bodhi, but Vajra Bodhi. The heart or the mind set on enlightenment came to be called the Vajra Chitta. If you like, the adamantine chitta. And similarly, that aspect of one's own being, in which one is identical with the Vajra reality, came to be spoken of as one's Vajra Kaya, usually translated as diamond body or adamantine body. But here Kaya means something like individuality or even personality. And then, on another level entirely, one finds the initiatic community spoken of as the Vajra Kula. The Vajra Kula. Now, what does this mean? Kula, literally, is family. Family in the ordinary sense, and also, more especially, spiritual family. A Kula is a community of people following the same spiritual path, the same spiritual tradition, usually also under the same spiritual master. And Vajra Kula is a spiritual community in a very special sense. A Vajra Kula is a community of people, a spiritual community of people, dedicated to direct experience of reality. They're not together for social reasons, not together to discuss texts, not together for the sake of argument, not together just to mull over their personal problems. They're dedicated simply to the direct experience of reality. And they're infused also with a common spiritual power. We may say also that the Vajra Kula is a community, a spiritual community, in which communication is completely authentic and completely real. This is why it is said symbolically, very often, that in the Vajra Kula, everybody is naked. No clothes. No veils. Nothing to conceal. Completely open. And I shall be having something to say on the spiritual significance of nakedness in Lecture 5, when we come to the symbolism of the cremation ground and the celestial maidens. We also have Vajra Giti, a Vajra Gita. Gita is song. And the Vajra Gita is the song sung by the tantric master, or sometimes a whole series of songs, a whole cycle of songs. And they're songs expressive of the spiritual master's direct experience of reality. Songs which sort of burst from their lips out of the fullness of their spiritual experience. And we may say in passing that many of these tantric masters, especially those in India during the Indian Middle Ages, were very unconventional figures indeed. They didn't look at all like gurus, they didn't behave at all like gurus, they didn't speak like gurus. Very often people didn't know that they were gurus. They often seemed to have wandered about like wandering minstrels, sort of troubadours. They didn't teach in any formal sort of way. They simply sang. They went about singing. Sometimes they'd sing without you asking. Sometimes they'd just sing, whether, as it were, you liked it or not. They sang out of the fullness of their hearts, out of their spiritual experience. They sang these Vajra Gitas. That was their way of communicating. That was their way, if you like, of teaching. We find a rather interesting parallel to this in the Pali Buddhist scriptures themselves, in the case of the Buddha himself. There's a whole section of the scriptures called the Udana, in the Pali canon, the Udana. And what does Udana mean? Udana literally means the outward going breath. The in and out going breath is called the Anapana. The outward going breath is the Udana. So the Udana, the book of the Udana, consists of little verses breathed out by the Buddha at times of great spiritual exaltation. Something happened, as it were, to the Buddha, say his enlightenment and various post-enlightenment experiences, some tremendous experience, something with a tremendous spiritual transcendental pressure, so that something surged up within him and he had to speak. He had to speak out, sometimes to the gods, sometimes to men, sometimes just to himself, out into the air as it were, out just to the cosmos at large. And he breathed these inspirational verses, or you might even say suspirational verses, these Udana. And the Vajragitis of the Vajracharyas, these wandering minstrel type figures in medieval India, were of much the same kind. They were engaged in all sorts of yogic practices, meditation, all sorts of unconventional practices, communication, and so on. Sometimes they stayed in hermitages, sometimes in the jungle, sometimes in cremation grounds. Sometimes they just lived at home with their wives and families. Sometimes they plied trade, sometimes they lived on alms, etc. But all the time there was a stream, a current of spiritual practice and spiritual experience going on. And sometimes it came surging up. They could not, as it were, contain it. It had to come out in some form, find some expression in words, in music, in song. And in this way you've got the Vajragiti, the diamond songs. And there are several collections of these Vajragita in tantric literature. The most famous, the most celebrated, is Sarahapada's Doha Kosha, or collection of songs. And the songs of Milarepa, we may say, are of the same kind, continue the same tradition. And then again, we find the term, the epithet Vajra, applied to various objects used in the tantric ritual. In all Buddhist ceremonies, in all Buddhist rites, flowers are offered. This is a very common practice. And the flower which is offered in the tantric ritual is known as the Vajra Pushpa, or the diamond flower. So what does this mean? Why not just a flower? Why does one call it the Vajra Pushpa? It means that when you offer the flower, when you place that flower on the altar, when you place that flower at the feet of the Buddha, you have at the same time to experience the ultimate reality of the flower. Experience what the flower really is, what the flower really means. You offer the Vajra Pushpa. You offer not just the phenomenal flower, but the transcendental flower, the flower in its transcendental essence at the same time. You experience what the flower really is in the depths of its flower being, as it were, and you offer that. And similarly with the Vajra bell, the Vajra ganta, and with everything else. It's Vajra this, Vajra that. So what does this mean? It means that in the tantric ritual, everything that you touch, everything that you handle, everything that you offer, everything that you do is imbued with this sense of ultimate reality. You experience ultimate reality as existing in its very depth. You don't just touch a bell, you touch a Vajra bell. You don't just offer a flower, it's a Vajra flower. You don't just light incense, it's Vajra incense. You're not just sitting in an enclosure, it's a Vajra enclosure. You're not just pouring water from pots, it's Vajra water and Vajra pots all the time. Everything Vajra, everything imbued with reality, everything imbued with the experience of reality. You experience everything, as it were, sacramentally, in its ultimate depth, in its ultimate essence, in the tantric ritual, the tantric ceremony. And this is a sort of model, it's a sort of paradigm of what one's life in the world should be. The ritual concentrates everything within a certain area. It creates a sort of ideal world. That's all right for the time being, just like going on retreat. Conditions are ideal for the time being, but back you must come into the world. Whatever you experienced in the ritual area, within the mandala as it were, whatever you experienced in the retreat, you have now to experience in the midst of your life in the world. Experience in the world at large. So this is what the multiplication of this Vajra epithet means. that one was to experience everything, all the time, under its Vajra aspect. Live as it were saturated by the experience of reality.